We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For the past 3 weeks now, Egypt has been rocked by political protest. Demonstrators have called on the country's president, Hosni Mubarak, to resign. Initially, his response was to say that he would not run again, but intended to fill out the rest of his term. Little else was offered in the way of meaningful concessions. We do have some developments this morning, and I'll just tell you what it is that the Associated Press is reporting. They write, President Mubarak will meet the demands of protesters, military and ruling party officials said Thursday, in the strongest indication yet that Egypt's longtime president may be about to give up power. The Supreme Council was meeting on Thursday without the commander-in-chief, President Mubarak, and announced on state TV that its, quote, support of the legitimate demands of the people, unquote. As spokesman said, the council was in permanent session to explore what measures and arrangements could be made to safeguard the nation, its achievements, and the ambitions of its great people. The military commander for the Cairo area told protesters in central Tahrir Square, he said, all your demands will be met today. Well, we're here to talk about what exactly all this means with our guest Asif Bayat in Cancun, and we're very pleased they could be here. Questions also, by the way, are welcome, as always. People want to call in, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you both very much for being here. We've been following this, and I've been checking in with the various news sources that I could get to, and the picture at this point seems rather confusing, and I suppose no one truly knows what exactly this means. As you hear some of the things that have been said, what do you think that means? And I suppose the big question is, well, does that really mean that Hosni Mubarak is about to step down?
Not necessarily. We'll just have to wait and see what happens. Last week, when news came that he was planning to address the nation in the evening, which he did, there was speculation that he was going to announce his resignation or a transfer of powers to the vice president, and it didn't happen. So I think the best thing is simply to wait and see what happens. We could discuss more rumors, but
I think that also the context is interesting, because it was last night or the night before that Omar Suleiman, the vice president, came up with tough really message that we are the issue of Mubarak or the end of regime is not on the card, and basically warned the protesters go home. And the notion that these protesters are there to demand democracy, he said to a journalist, Christian Amanpour, that Egyptians are not ready for democracy. So it's interesting to see, to combine these two. Mm-hmm. And
well, he scolded the demonstrators for demanding Mubarak's departure before September. Mm-hmm. So right. This is what Asif is saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Well, let me ask let's step back a little bit, because ask a basic question. Hosni Mubarak has been president of Egypt for 30 years now. He became president when Anwar Sadat was assassinated in 1981. And that also was the time that the emergency law was passed, which has the government clearly has used to quash dissent and make it virtually impossible for any kind of opposition to organize to challenge the government. So that's now been in effect also since 1981. Clearly, for years now, people in Egypt have been unhappy with Mr. Mubarak and the regime and have hoped for change. Why now? Why are we seeing this now? Is there something that has happened? You know, what happened on the 25th of January that suddenly we had this explosion of protest?
Right. I think that there are, of course, underlying reasons that in the course of this program we will explore those. But just immediately answer your question, It is very true that since that time, there has been, and I've been actually living there for a long time, observing that there has been real dissent on the part of a vast majority of the Egyptians. And there have been really protests as well, protests on the part of labor, of students, and also even the traditional political organizations. However, most of the sort of the direction of the protests that they have had on the street largely have been directed against sort of foreign, powers, whether it is United States involvement in the Middle East or especially Israel. So for years there has been some kind of a convergence between people's demand for a national dignity. It has been a convergence with, people's dissent and demand for national dignity, and the rulers, Mubarak. Mubarak also has been there to be very critical against Israel and so on. So there has been largely nationalistic dissent. However, in recent years, this has changed. And basically, people now focus more on the internal issues. That even if we want to resolve this issue of foreign domination, the first step would be to establish a democratic state, because Mubarak regime really has failed to resolve that particular issue. Mm. And of course, what happened in Tunisia was the first step for the Egyptians, showing that it is possible, in fact, to get rid of a dictator who has been there for 23 years.
Mm. Do you want to add
anything? Well, we're of course scrambling to assess with 2020 hindsight what was going on leading up to this, and I think that the decade of since 2000 will turn out to be crucial. There are a number of developments that may have led to a conjuncture of sorts, which is not to denigrate the important organizing that was done behind the protests. But one of the factors was economic. Starting in fact, if you go to the CIA World Factbook, which I was consulting last night to update my data, you'll see under economy they say that an aggressive policy of privatization was pursued between 2004 and 2008. Now this coincides, by the way, with an upsurge of labor activity and strikes, almost all illegal because strikes are illegal in Egypt. During that same period, workers protesting over cutbacks in jobs, cutbacks in benefits, the failure of wages to keep up with inflation, and privatization means downsizing the labor force or reducing benefits. So, and the push for that, of course, was coming from the American-controlled IMF and World Bank, who control the one-third of aid to Egypt that we give them that is economic. And we've been pushing this sort of market fundamentalist policy on them since the mid-1970s, when they aligned themselves with us. So that is a factor. And in fact, one of the two main organizations, Facebook-based, networky-based organizations behind the protest, is called the April 6th Movement, or April 6th Youth Movement, which was formed in 2008 as an expression of solidarity with strikers in Mahalla. I think it was Mahalla to Kubra, which is a major industrial town in the center of the Delta, textile production mainly. And so April 6th of that year was the day of solidarity, in which a general strike was called by these activists in the country in support of the workers. And to their own surprise, they got something like 70,000 subscribers to this Facebook page very, very early on. And it's grown since then. So there is also a connection. There's the increasingly dire economic circumstances, the upsurge of labor activism, which we're seeing coming back in the last couple of days, again, with wildcat strikes. And then this connects up with the human rights social media-based organizers as well. Going back to the 90s, too, the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least a younger generation, sort of middle-aged Muslim brothers, not the crusty old founders, We're also reaching out to other activists, and a dialogue was beginning, believe it or not, between liberals and leftists who have a secular vision of the future of Egypt and these, what you might call more moderate Muslim Brotherhood activists. That was part and parcel of them running candidates for the parliament, but also another feature of that that's gotten less attention was their much greater success in running candidates for the heads of the professional syndicates, the doctors' syndicate, the lawyers' syndicate in particular, journalists and so forth and so on. And all the in Egypt, the professions are organized in syndicates, which are like labor unions.
Yeah. Well, just Professor Bayat mentioned the events in Tunisia. And we have seen popular protest drive the leader from power. After that, also, we saw something sort of similar in Algeria, in Yemen, clearly in Amman and in Saudi Arabia. They're worried. The governments there are concerned about this. I wonder whether you think that had not the protest happened in Tunisia, whether you think we would be seeing this in Egypt. How direct a connection is there, do you think?
Yeah. I think it is very difficult to say. I mean, it is very difficult to say in what way things really began to unfold in Tunisia. I think the fact that it happened in Tunisia had a very significant impact, I would say, on Egypt, no doubt about it. But then our task would be to explain what happened in Tunisia, why it happened. That's even a more difficult, question really to pose. But at any rate, I think the revolution in Tunisia definitely has impacted. And it has impacted not the Egypt, but as you mentioned, I think it has inspired different kinds of movements in different countries of the Middle East. But I think that raises the question of whether or not this is the beginning of a kind of a democratic revolution, in the Middle East. I would say that sure, basically revolutions do inspire, people around the region. And in different countries with similar circumstances, for people to rise up and make their claims. And it has already in the context of the Middle East. However, revolutions also make the states, the regimes, more vigilant and in some way resistant, so that the regimes also watching what is happening. Mm-hmm. So they will try to pursue policies of repression or reform in order to not to allow such a thing happen in their own sort of backyard. So maybe it is too early really to say that this is going to really affect the entire region. Of course, the whole thing really depends upon mostly depends upon the street, the cohesiveness of popular movements, and of course the regional players, as well as the United States. So these are really three major players that somewhat will determine the future of the region.
Let me introduce again, just very quickly, our guests. Asif Bayat is professor of sociology and Middle East studies. Ken Kuno is associate professor of history, African studies, South Asian and Middle Eastern studies. People around here have these really long titles. We're talking about current events in Egypt, both of them scholars who have spent a lot of time following contemporary Egyptian politics and the history of modern Egypt. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things I wonder, I'm sure that there are people in Egypt who owe their jobs and their livelihood to the government. So are directly employed and would be counted on to at least be supporters of the government, if not supporters of Mr. Mubarak. Mm-hmm. But apart from people like that, I do wonder who it is in Egypt. Are there still in Egypt people who support him and support the government?
Well, evidently, because the American media who are over there are doing what American reporters do. They look for the other side of the coin. And every once in a while, I've noticed a story where they do turn up somebody who expresses concern or says, no, we like Mubarak. people, and in fact, until these recent developments, my take was that even the people who were really fed up with the regime were worried about what would come after, mm-hmm. that they had been convinced by this line that the government was putting out, that it's, you know, it's either Mubarak or chaos, or either it's either Mubarak or the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course that's been proven to be wrong now. The government is a huge employer. I mean, the public sector has not been entirely dismantled, and so it's been pointed out that the police force or the security forces altogether are larger than the army, or about twice the size of the army. So, and it's not just that it's a police state. This is also a jobs program for people as well. So lots and lots of families are dependent upon the government. But also the entire, what you might call the cultural sector, the vast majority of the cultural sector, writers, artists and whatnot, are employed by the government or work somehow through institutes, because the government has not privatized, quote unquote, culture so much. Mm-hmm. And these are many of these people, of course, are staunchly on the side of the demonstrators.
Well, of course, I mean, almost in every big movement, in every revolution, you have, of course, the adversaries, the regime people, and then you have the activists, the protagonists, and that they might garner support among the vast majority of people. But you always would have also the so-called free riders, those who are not necessarily activists, but they want others to do change for them. And they usually vacillate because they are thinking of the future, what would happen to them. I think there have been, you know, some of these free riders expressing their views about, okay, what happens if Mubarak, leaves now, or basically arguing that, well, Mubarak has already said that he's not going to run for the elections next time, so therefore it's enough, you know, that change. Mm-hmm. But however, with the unfolding of the events, it seems to me, with the connections that I have in Egypt, these people are really changing their mind. In particular, I think with the coming to the television of Ghunaim, who is Wael Ghunaim, who is one of the now has become the leaders of the movement. He was the
Google executive
who was arrested.
He gave a very emotional interview, and a very, very powerful interview. And I think that changed a lot of minds. Mm. And you know, when you look at the Facebooks, you see that the expression of the friends who were or people who were doubtful are changing and becoming more and more sympathetic to the movement.
Well, it seemed, you know, early on, it seemed that the big question was, well, who would be the individuals or the organizations around which people could coalesce and organize? And right immediately, one of the things people thought was, well, Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. Even though it's officially banned, it's maybe one of the biggest opposition entities that there is. And then, of course, we had Mr. Mohammed Elbaradei, the former head of the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, as someone. And we talked, I don't know when it was we last talked, Ken, about him coming back to Egypt and and his involvement in Egyptian mm-hmm. politics. Now I'm not so sure about either Muslim Brotherhood or Mohammed Elbaradei. So who is there around? Is there a person or persons around which people can organize?
Well, there are organizers, and in fact, in this morning's New York Times, it was a very interesting article. Based upon some of these organizers coming forward and identifying themselves and giving interviews, but that has to do more with tactics. In addition to Elbaradei, who seems to have some, there seems to be some skepticism toward him because he's been out of Egypt for so long. And of course, he, until a couple of years ago, he was expecting to just have a quiet retirement, I think. So not entirely in touch, but I think he's handled it pretty deftly for himself, at least, saying he's available if people want him, but he's not really pushing himself to the forefront. Another individual is Amr Moussa, who is the current head of the Arab League, Secretary General, and he's a former foreign minister of Mubarak's, but that's enough years back that he doesn't seem to be too closely associated. And he went to the Tahrir demonstrations a few days ago and sort of, in a sense, said, "I'm with you." But it's very hard to say who exactly would emerge as a leader. There's no man on a white horse. Mm-hmm. But if things go the way that the demonstrators have been demanding, let's bear in mind that they're not talking about a complete overturning of the organs of the state. You know, the army, nobody's questioning that the army will still be there. And the demonstrators want the army there, but they're talking about the civilian leadership being changed as a result of a transitional period in which there would be what they call a national unity government, which remains to be defined. So in other words, not all the props will be kicked out from underneath if that plan is followed.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's also one of the problem really of the movement right now is that it has been things have developed so fast, and it's been just over 2 weeks. Hmm. You know, within 2 weeks, what can you do? In what way you can actually not only to organize a massive sort of movement, but also put together a leadership that is, of course, acceptable to the members of the movement. I think largely right now the leadership is collective, is constituted of different sort of traditional political parties and the person of Al-Baradei and 6th of April youth movement. And so the variety of them, I think Al-Baradei acts like an elder to bring all these different organization together to give it some cohesion. However, Omar Suleiman, he does not want to give legitimacy to him. He was not invited for a negotiation, even though he did send his representative to negotiate, the first round of negotiation. So right now, really, it is an issue. Perhaps in the next, couple of weeks, we will know whether a leader will emerge. Yeah. And that, of course, differentiates, for instance, this in an earlier revolutions with one person actually embodies, the will of the people, mm-hmm. and like Ayatollah Khomeini during the Iranian Revolution. So in a sense, that gives much more cohesion to a movement and therefore more effective.
We're about at a midpoint here already. Our guests in this hour, Asef Bayat and Kenan Kuno. Asef Bayat is professor of sociology. Ken Kuno is historian. Both of them follow contemporary Egyptian politics, and we are talking about what has been going on there in Egypt in the past couple of weeks. Questions welcome. We do have someone here to talk with. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And here's a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
With myself rather objecting to what I think is American continuation of European colonialism, trying to demand and exercise control over other people's government, what is the possibility that the ordinary Middle Eastern way of deposing an unpopular governor or leader by having a large military parade, honorariums prescribed and lavished upon the person, and then perhaps 2 or 3 weeks or months later, having them drink the glass of hemlock, because that's the way things are done.
I really don't think that's the way things are done.
Well, it did happen to Nasser.
No, sir. Nasser had a stroke. He died in office from a stroke.
Amen. Bye-bye.
All right.
I take the first point of the caller there is an uncanny resemblance between what official Washington has been saying about the demonstrations so far and the discourse surrounding the 1919 revolution in Egypt or the Arabi revolution of 1881-82. Too, that the instability comes first and it trumps the desires of the people for participatory government.
And also, I think that, you know, again, perhaps now we are moving into what the administration, U.S. administration thinks and imagines about what is happening in Egypt. I think that there has been some unease, really, on the part of the administration how effectively deal with the situation. It seems to me that they are really somewhat afraid of a fundamental change in Egypt.
Well, it's scary.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, of course, you know, big powers necessarily do not want democracy, despite the fact that they are actually talking about democracy. I think there are different players in the region that really are afraid of giving power to people. That's the problem, really. Mm-hmm. I think that, for instance, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu really would like to have Omar Suleiman as the effective leader of Egypt, because he feels that he can actually deal with him as he has dealt with him in the past, rather than having a country in which you have a parliament and there's a debate and discussion, and that the outcome might be sort of not necessarily desirable for countries like Israel or United States, mm-hmm. or for that matter, Saudi Arabia. In fact, there is now the coalition of, you know, conservative powers in the region, including UAE and Saudi Arabia and Israel, that want, you know, some kind of a superficial change, but not really the real one.
Mm. Well, clearly the United States has to go very carefully here. I think early on some people were critical of President Obama because he didn't come right out and say to Hosni Mubarak, well, you should just go. Which is, I don't really think, something he could have done. And I'm sure that the democracy movement or the movement for political reform in Egypt would not want it to appear that somehow it was being directed by the United States. And that, you know, the United States also wouldn't want it to look as if we were somehow pulling the strings on that. So here the United States, I'm sure that there are outcomes the United States would like to see, but the ability to influence them very directly is very small, if at all. So what does the United States do here? What can the United States do?
Well, I think they can have a more consistent message and keep the pressure on to reform. And it seems in the last 24 to 36 hours they've been coming back to that after they realized that they were being played by the regime, which was announcing, you know, through state media that they had met the all of the protesters' demands and formed committees, and they were doing all these things, and it was all the same old window dressing. And in the meantime, the protesters said, no, none of our demands had been met, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's been some pushback from the administration, but it's shameful that they haven't taken a consistent. A stronger and more consistent stand in pressurizing the regime to move in the direction of reforms, because they've, for 30 years, well, more than that, if you go back to Sadat's time, they have resisted pressures for economic and political reforms. Mm.
Well, let me pass on to now just an update here. It just has come in from the Associated Press. They're reporting that Egyptian state TV says that President Mubarak will be speaking to the nation Thursday night from his palace in Cairo. The story goes on to read, the announcement comes after Egypt's military proclaimed on national television that it stepped in to, quote, safeguard the country and assured protesters that Mubarak will meet their demands. And apparently also in Washington, the head of the CIA, not named here, it says CIA chief, but it says CIA chief said there was, quote, a strong likelihood that Mubarak will step down today.
It's 6:30 p.m. in Cairo right now, so
So it may be sometime soon.
Shortly, you know, shortly, right. Put on Al Jazeera and
I don't think we get Al Jazeera here. We'll continue to follow the developments, and we'd be very happy to also have comments, questions, by the way, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guests are historian Ken Cuno, a sociologist Asif Bayat. They're both here from the University of Illinois. Let's talk about the Army. This has been an interesting part of the story here that apparently the Army, at least in what I read, the description is, well, the Army decided to stay neutral not weigh in on the side of the government, although it seems also true that at the point where pro-government demonstrators attacked the anti-government demonstrators, also the Army didn't really do much to help the anti-Mubarak people, but at least they didn't assist in the attack. What is the position of the Army here, and what sort of power does it have? What sort of power can it exercise?
Well, there's somewhat contradictory reports out there. Of course, the top brass of the Army are now running the country as the foreign minister, the defense minister, and the vice president, Omar Suleiman. And according to WikiLeaks documents that have been reported upon, some of these very, very senior people are regarded as part of the problem by the junior grade officers, although whether that will lead to anything, who knows. There are also reports in reputable venues like The Guardian of England that thousands of demonstrators have been detained by the military and are being held incommunicado. And I haven't seen that. There's not much detail beyond that, but this is based upon human rights organizations reporting. So there's that. Then there's, of course, this role that they're playing more or less of kind of trying to stand between the demonstrators and the thugs. But
I think, in general, the image of the army in the Egyptian society, in the past three decades or so, have been a positive one. In fact, institution of the army, according to World Values sort of survey, institution of the army has been one of the most trusted institutions in Egypt. And so, at the beginning of this uprising, there was some kind of a convergence between the sort of desires of the army and that of the people. So we see, you know, in the streets that soldiers come out and they hug demonstrators and they hug back and so forth. However, in the past, you know, a couple of days, there is now, as Ken said, the revelations that the army actually has been really behind of a lot of sort of arrests and so on that has been really going on, in the sense that while the general image that army wants to give is one of an institution to protect the nation and stay neutral, but in fact, behind the scenes, they are really major players in trying to somewhat neutralize the movement. And I think that's at least one view. Another view is that army, you don't have a homogeneous military in Egypt. In fact, it is somewhat divided, and there are different constituencies within the army. Army is not just an army, it is also a big business organization. It does a lot of civil work, in fact. It has, you know, factories, it has bakeries, it has roads construction, and so forth. But also you have, on the one hand, the army, you have also Air Force. You know, some analysts argue that the Air Force actually is much more closer to the establishment, whereas army has a different view, and this is reflected by, for instance, Tantawi coming out among the demonstrators. Now, it is not clear whether it genuinely he came out to support the demonstrators or really, again, to present himself as man of people and army as a protector of the nation and somewhat an institution that goes along with the interests of people.
I think the protesters' message to the army basically is that they don't intend to dislodge the army from its, or the military from its privileged position, because they know that they couldn't go up against the military. So I think they're hoping to neutralize the and keep them neutral.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. And Muhammad is next. They're first in line. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. I wonder if you could. I would make an observation and listen to you address it. It occurs to me that we're spending a fortune on military intelligence and social intelligence, and not to mention academia. And given that that's, you know, sort of the idea that you have a paradigm that is in place in among experts, and yet then you have the anomaly of something happened in Tunis that rocks the whole system, like, if not to its foundations, at least gives it a pretty good wobble. And there were people, I think, that understood that this would happen, but they weren't in the establishment. The general run of opinion didn't seem to reflect that, and the United States seems to be behind the curve on this one, as it often is. And then the other point, sort of tangentially, is doesn't any government have to be for the status quo to some extent? And we can't be fostering revolution everywhere in the world, can we? And I'll just let you speak to those issues if you'd like to.
Maybe I'll speak to the first point and you to the with regard to expertise. Well, it's curious because the United States government has spent a fair amount of money. I don't know what the total number dollar amount is since the 1950s when they created the higher what's now called the Higher Education Act, which among other things funds graduate students to learn what they call critical languages. These are kind of exotic languages like Chinese and Arabic and whatnot. With the idea of building up area expertise in the universities, but also that could be drawn upon for in policymaking organs. But politically, what has happened over the past 50 years is that the people who make the policy decisions, and oftentimes the people who have the input into policymaking circles in Washington, are not products of that educational process. We end up, I'm one of them, we end up at universities and we are routinely ignored, if not disdained, by the Washington elite because they want to know how can we do what we've already decided to do. And our reaction is, but that's a dumb idea. And they go, oh, well, you've gone native, forget it. So really you have the Washington inside the Beltway people talking to each other. And this is part of the problem that's going on right now, I think.
Yeah, but whether or not people were expecting such a revolution to take place, certainly, well, as far as I understand it, at least I don't know anybody really expected this to happen, say, in Tunisia. I think it caught many people by surprise. Really, I do not think that Bouazizi, who ignited himself and then ignited a revolution, had the intention of necessarily forging a revolutionary movement. Revolutions are not really plannable. I mean, of course, a lot of people do plan revolutions, and revolutions do happen, but revolutions do not happen because people have planned it. Usually, revolutions have their own really intriguing logic. Yeah. But certainly, it affects, however, the sentiments. It affects the movements in other places, including Egypt itself. But I think, however, usually what is the case is that the elites usually understand the message usually late. And this is what my sociologist friend Mohamed Bamir calls elite deafness. In other words, people come out and make demands, and then they are usually late in answering those demands. And now people in Egypt saying that if Mubarak was not late in coming on television saying the kind of things that he did 1 week later, probably things might be different. But so he comes late and he actually tries to concede inch by inch. So this is not basically acceptable to the movement, which is accelerating so fast.
Let's we'll try and get in, another caller here in Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
Yes.
It seems to me that something that you haven't really discussed, you're sort of tiptoeing around, are the consequences that would exist in American policy, in policies in general, in the Middle East, if, in fact, the regime in Egypt were overthrown in some dramatic way. In other words, what would be the consequences for the whole region if, in fact, the a democratic new kind of government were installed in Egypt with respect to Israel, with respect to Saudi Arabia, with respect to the Emirates, etc. One hasn't really broached how serious this is to the planners in Washington and how that's going to affect the progress of what's happening right now. Mm. Just like you to speak to that.
Excellent question. You want to, Ken? Go ahead.
Okay, I think I think that a democratic Egypt does not necessarily want to end peace treaty with Israel.
But that's not. It's not only the peace treaty. It's the support of the Palestinians. It's what's happening in Gaza, etc.
Already, Egyptian people are supporting the Palestinian people, the legitimate rights of the Palestinians. And I don't think necessarily that would lead to, as I said, deterioration of the relationship between Egypt and Israel. In fact, even Ahmad al-Muslimin already said that they are not interested in, ending that treaty. What will, I think, the consequence would be that it is very likely that such a successful revolution would make the incumbent dictatorial regimes in the region to be more really careful about their own policies. Hopefully, one would expect that they would introduce reform perhaps from the top in order to avoid such a monumental sort of uprising in their own countries, so that the change would be perhaps more orderly, and that would be really to their own benefit.
Well, I wonder. I just have to add, insofar as the Israeli attack upon Gaza just in recent times, whether in fact the Egyptian government would be as calm and unhelpful to the people of Gaza if there were a different regime as there is now. I think that could be a dramatic change. So I'm right. Disagreeing with you somewhat. Okay.
All right. Well, do you want to add anything to that, Ken?
It's all speculative. It's as Asif mentioned, I mean, Egyptians regard the Gaza situation or the situation of the people in Gaza as a human rights situation, whereas, of course, the Israelis, and I think the caller is constructing it more as a security problem for Israel. The protesters have simply not, addressed foreign issues. They've been very disciplined and stuck with a small list of demands with regard to the internal politics. And so it remains to be seen what would happen. And that's all I can say. I really don't think, though, a democratic Egypt poses a danger to Israel. It poses probably a much, much more danger, by example, to places like Libya and Syria. Mm-hmm.
We'll try again. We have another call. We'll try to get them in quickly. Line one, Champagne. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yes, I did want to point out one thing that there could be a change, and that is in the. I believe that certainly whoever comes to power, they probably will adhere to the terms of the peace treaty with Israel. But at the time of the ratification of the peace treaty with Israel, the Egyptian government reserved its right to come to the defense of Arab states attacked by Israel pursuant to their defense commitments, both bilaterally and under UN Charter Article 51 and the League of Arab States. Now, shortly after signing the peace treaty, then Begin attacked Lebanon in outright aggression. This was in 1978.
No, and 82.
The first time was 78. Then there was 82.
The treaty was 79, so you're talking about 82.
All right. Well, in any event, the Camp David Accords were 77, and he attacked in 78 to test and see if Egypt would live up to them. In any event, Egypt so far has done nothing to come to grips with Israeli aggression, repeated aggression against Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. And it very well could be, if a new government comes to power, although they will adhere to the peace treaty with Israel, they would not take the same position in the event that Israel were to resume acts of aggression against Syria, Lebanon, or Palestine.
All right. Well, comment?
Well, it's simply not in Egypt's interest to reopen hostilities with Israel, period. I mean, and you can construct what Israel does as defensive or aggressive either way, but Egypt has fought five wars with Israel. They believe largely on the behalf of somebody else, the Palestinians. I can guarantee you that line of argument would not impress most Egyptians.
But in kind of a general point I can make is that usually the revolutionary states, that is the states, regimes that come to power after a revolution, do not usually start war. In fact, they are often the subject of war by others, mm-hmm. whether it is a Russian revolution, Iranian revolution, and almost any
French revolution.
So if you follow, you know, that sort of historical logic, I don't think that new Egyptian regime in a possible post-revolution will not necessarily open hostility because it is against its own interests. Mm.
Real quickly, we're getting very short on time. There has been a lot of speculation about what, if there is a dramatic change of government, what the next government would be like. And there are a lot of people who are concerned that we would see an Islamic State that would be modeled on Iran. And certainly President Mubarak, I think that's a fear that he has encouraged. I think also, though, there are people who look at Egypt and say, actually, that's not a very likely thing to occur. Can you talk about, again, address that kind of question that people have?
Yeah, there's a very good analytical piece about the Muslim Brotherhood in Foreign Affairs right now by Carrie Wickham. And she points out that the Brotherhood is not all of one mind, but that the ones who are sort of driving their engagement right now with the protests are this younger group who are interested in putting a civil state, the goal of a civil state first, and then participating in the same way that, say, in that system, in the same way that, say, a Christian Democratic Party in a European or a South American state would participate in a legal electoral system.
I think this concern or this idea of an Islamic revolution in Egypt really comes from three sources. One is Mubarak himself, right? And the other one is Netanyahu. And the third is, interestingly, Ayatollah Khamenei of Iran. So, yes, except that they are doing for different reasons. Mm-hmm. But they converge in identifying or trying to identify what is happening in Egypt and Islamic. But I think reality is really far from that. I think what happened in Iran, was led largely by an identifiable religiously, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who sort of embodied the revolution, and once he is in Iran, he used very elaborate sort of Shia institutions and the new revolutionary institution that had been created in the course of 6 months or so in a final push to establish an Islamic State. Whereas in Egypt, you don't have such a figure. And the leadership of the revolution basically do not utter an Islamic slogan. They don't say that we want an Islamic state or Islamic regime. On the contrary, the major sort of player or religious player here, Muslim Brotherhood, explicitly say that basically we are not even interested in participating in a post-Mubarak administration. I think partially because, of course, they are pretty popular and they can garner some.
Of course, that's an easy concession to make because the law, as currently written, blocks them from participating
anywhere.
We're going to have to stop. And again, I just mentioned that the Associated Press is reporting that Egyptian state TV says that President Hosni Mubarak will be speaking to the nation tonight, and it already is tonight. So we expect that maybe in the next couple of hours we'll have some more news to pass on, and we will do that. It will continue to follow the story. Perhaps sometime in the near future you can come back, and when we know more, we can talk some more. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Asef Bayat is a professor of sociology here at the U of I, and Ken Kuno is a professor of history.